This week, we explore a piece by Joseph Fort Newton. What does he have to say about a lodge that simply makes masons? Then, we read a short piece from Brother Stephen E. Patrick. Is there a history of a tracing board on beer mugs? We'll wrap it up with a piece that explores the early days of masonry. Apprentices, masters, then fellows? Was the fellow more important than the master? Find out this and a whole lot more in this episode coming right up. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 469. First things first, I want to go ahead and thank all of our contributors, our fellows, our producers to the Whence Came You podcast. Without you, we can't do the program. You make it all possible. If you want to learn more how to become a contributor, a fellow, or a producer, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show. We've been doing this since 2011. Yeah, almost 10 years. It's crazy. And we wouldn't be able to do the program without the generous support of you all. We have three tiers, of course, that contributor level, $2 a month, fellow $5, producer $10. What do you get for that? Well, aside from the feel-good that you have by assisting bringing Masonic education to the masses the world over, you also get your name on the website, a personalized card from me, a thank you card, and a producer's pin. And we do that through Patreon, or you can do it through PayPal, or you can even make a one-time gift. So any of those things are very welcome, and I thank you in advance for checking them out. Other ways to support this show. We just launched kind of a new thing. So we have a limited edition shop that we've had forever, and there you can buy the producer's pin. You can buy the Masonicon Chicago limited gear. So we have the Masonicon Chicago 2020 pin, the coin, or the collector set for both. And we also have It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Freemasonry, that I'll autograph, a book I wrote with John Ruark, another brother, close friend of mine. And so any of those things are there and available for you to check out. But we also have this new pin called Hello Hiram. Is perhaps not such a crazy idea. It's basically a neat little sticker pin. It's not obnoxious, and it's available as an add-on for $2 on any purchase from our website. So you can go to the website, you see limited edition shop, you'll see the producer's pin, and you can pick just the producer's pin, $10, or producer's pin plus Hiram pin, $12, and check out that way. And we've done that with everything else. And you know there is another pin on our website that you can get. It's called the 15%er. Here's the catch. The only way to get it is if you attend Lodge with me and you have to ask for it. But we haven't been able to get in Lodge, so we might have a few more of those available at some point when we get back to meeting in person. In the news, I think I mentioned it once before, but I was lucky enough to be on the 13 Questions podcast, Man Transcending. Basically, the 13 Questions podcast is pretty neat, you guys. I think a lot of Freemasons might enjoy it. It's not Masonic, but the description is wisdom delivered for the 21st century, interviewing someone different every episode, some average, some not. We ask 13 questions in the free version with 5 more bonus questions in the members section. So join as they learn about relationships, fatherhood, responsibilities, belief, and how we might be better for those we care about. I think it's a great podcast. I listened to a few episodes before I agreed to be on, and it was really great. So I was on episode, it's just titled Robert Johnson. I think it was episode 42. It was released on October 19th. So feel free to check them out. I'll have a link back in the show notes. I also had the privilege of being on Meet, Act, and Part once again, and I was part of a panel discussion who grilled Brother Darren Lehners, worshipful Brother Darren Lehners, about his most recent article for the Midnight Freemasons, which was titled, Does Freemasonry Develop Talent? And as part of that cool panel, we actually brought on Lisa, who works for some great talent acquisition stuff and deals with a lot of things in kind of the nonprofit corporate world with talent and management and those kind of things. So we had a really great conversation. Greg Knott led us through was a great interlocutor for this particular episode. So if that sounds great to you, head on over to meetactandpart.com and check out their podcast. If you are somebody who likes to get on Patreon and give money to artists who put together great things, for instance, if you're contributing to the Whence Came You podcast on Patreon, thank you very much. But also understand that Meet, Act, and Part is also on Patreon. And I think if you've got a dollar or two or something, consider it. It's a great podcast that they have put together as well. I'll have links back to that as well in the show notes, just like the others. And let's go ahead and get into this week's Masonic Education. Now, if I have time, we'll get all three of these in, but if not, two. And for that, I would like to start this week by reading a piece called For the Good of the Order, and it's by Joseph Fort Newton. Now, before I jump into the piece, I do want to say that what is interesting is, for the longest time, I always viewed Joseph Fort Newton as just some guy that wasn't, you know, some kind of prolific Masonic author or anything. And this is because the things that I had read from him, I was not really impressed by. But that's my fault, because I actually did not read some of his great works. I never had read The Builders, which is a phenomenal book, or anything like that. So, shame on me. If you're one of those people as well who heard the name, you know, Joseph Fort Newton and just kind of tossed it to the wayside because you thought he was a basic bro and wasn't writing about anything spiritual or occult or philosophical and was caught up on the administration, Americana side of Masonry or something like that, think again. Joseph Fort Newton is a pretty interesting character. And I think you'll agree if you read a book like The Builders. And so, without any further delays, let's go ahead and jump into this piece, For the Good of the Order, Joseph Fort Newton. So, in this paper, Joseph Fort Newton is speaking directly after a report that had been given in Washington from the Executive Commission, I believe, of the MSA. He begins. After listening so intently to this remarkable report, no one wishes to hear a long speech from anybody. But, inasmuch as the report referred so kindly to me, perhaps I may be allowed a personal word, if only to tell in what mood I take up the work, and the spirit in which I hope to do it. First, let me tell a story. During the American Civil War, a young captain in the Army of the South was taken prisoner and brought up the Mississippi to Rock Island. The northern climate was severe on the southern men, proof of which can be found in the files of the War Department. The young captain fell ill, desperately ill. He made himself known as a Mason the officer took him out of the prison to his home and nursed him back to life. When the war ended, he put money in his pocket and gave him a little pistol to protect himself on his way back to his southern home. That young captain was my father. So, as far back as I can remember, I have had a great admiration for a fraternity whose spirit could soften the horrors of battle and mitigate the lot of a prisoner of war. By the same token, I hope I have done a little for Freemasonry in return, trying feebly to repay a measureless obligation. For the same reason, I should like to do more in its behalf before the day ends. Since those far-off years, all of us have lived through a great war, and no man can pass through such a ordeal and be the same man he was before. Something died in me, and I was buried with four boys. I buried in Flanders 527 of them in one day. All bitterness, bigotry, and all ill will, if I ever had any toward any race or creed, lie dead and buried with that war. Never have I had a deeper pity for my race, a greater love for my country, or a firmer faith that Freemasonry can do something for the rebuilding of the broken brotherhood of the world that nothing else can do. It was in the old gray city of London, at that time an arsenal and a hospital, that I first heard of the organization of the Masonic Service Association of the United States. It was one of the best bits of news that came in the days when good news was rare. When I learned of the basis on which the association was organized and the program it meant to carry through, it was like a dream come true. Now at last, I felt that American Masonry had begun to realize both its opportunity and its obligations, and I had a great longing to have a part, however small, in such a work. The purpose of the association, as I understood it, sought to fulfill three basic principles of Freemasonry: brotherly love, relief, and truth, the doing of good, and the spreading of light in the spirit of goodwill, living under the shadow of a vast tragedy. Trying to think and pray in the rhythm of its guns, it seemed to me that what the world needed was more light, more love, more understanding, and that is what it needs today. Our program is twofold. First, to bring American Freemasonry together in cooperative fellowship and service in a time of need and calamity, and second, to educate Masons in Masonry, that gentle, kindly light which shines on our altar may find its way through our lives and through our lodges into the world of partisan strife and sectarian feud where it is needed. What we want is a service that educates, and an education that serves. The whole principle of Freemasonry is that brotherhood of man begins with the manhood of the brother. It seeks to build men, and then to make them brothers and builders. Any other kind of brotherhood is weak, if not futile, either a flabby sentimentalism or a calculating selfishness. Masonry is made up of strong men, picked men. They cannot be picked too carefully, sworn and trained to make righteousness and goodwill prevail. By that very fact, a great responsibility rests upon us, which we cannot escape even if we desire to do so. Whatever needs to be done in any community, the Masons ought to be the leaders in doing it, because they are builders. Every Masonic lodge ought to be a social and civic center, where designs are drawn upon the trestle board for the common good, regardless of sect or party. At first glance, our program may seem to be rather academic and highbrow, but it can be modified and adapted to our real needs and problems. No man, no set of men, can make such a program outright. It is by doing things that we learn what needs to be done and how best to do it. If we work together wisely, keeping the human touch and the spiritual vision, our experiments will ripen into a fruitful experience of how the spirit and principles of Freemasonry can be practically applied to the life and service of our generation, as Washington and Franklin wrought its genius into the organic law of our new republic. Frankly, my first thought is not of the men who are already Masonic students. We need them, of course, and I believe they will rally to our help as they did when we founded the Research Society. No, we are thinking of the throngs of our young men, shock-headed boys, God bless them, who are crowding into our temples all over the land. We welcome their youth, their energy, their enthusiasm, but we want them to be Masons, not merely members. We want them to know something about Masonry, not only its ritual, but what the ritual means and what Masonry can do and ought to do in the world. Otherwise, as is so often the case, they will drift away and become bread-and-butter Masons, attending the big meets and the big eats, using the Masonic apron for a napkin. Such men ought to have a special apron of their own, adorned with a knife and a fork as emblems. Perhaps it is not altogether their fault. The lodge that simply makes Masons and does not teach Masonry does only half its work, or does its work only halfway. If we do not know Masonry ourselves, if we do not know how to teach it to our young initiates, if our lodges become simply mills grinding out degrees, our Freemasonry will sink into the level of a club, useful as such, but in no way unique, losing its original purpose and power, and its great opportunity in our day. Always the first principle of education is to excite curiosity, to awaken interest, hence the plan of this association. A few items of which I wish to mention without going into far detail. The moving picture program seemed to make use of one of the greatest arts of our time to enlist interest in Freemasonry by showing what it means when actually worked out in modern life. In the same way, the MSA, National Masonic Library, will bring the best thought of the craft within the reach of the lodges and members, and our proposed journal, The Master Mason, will be a medium for the exchange of ideas, plans, and methods, and good fellowship, and a means of learning the present state of Freemasonry in all lands, its aspirations, and its difficulties. Besides, we hope to enter the strangely neglected field of fiction using another great art in the service of the craft. Hitherto, except for the stories of Brother Kipling, we have had few Masonic stories. The men of the craft, like all other Americans, read stories, and it will be good news to know that one of the greatest of American novelists, has promised to write, as only he can write, the story of Freemasonry and the American Revolution. When our young men read that story, their blood will tingle and their hearts will beat faster as they see and realize what a part Masonry had in the creation of our republic. Also, there will be short stories dramatizing the meaning of Masonry and its creative influence in the practical life as we know and live it. Masonic research, as I understand it, means to search again for something we may have forgotten or overlooked. There are treasures of truth in our Freemasonry and sources of power we have not yet dreamed of, much less used. We need to know the past of Masonry in order to keep us true to its spirit, its purpose, and its methods. And I think I have shown a not unworthy interest in the history and archaeology of the craft. But we must also make research into the present meaning, power, and application of Freemasonry, the better to know what our great order of builders ought to do and can do for the making of a greater and better America. The philanthropies of the craft are munificent and its opportunities are magnificent. Brethren, I believe in America as I believe in God, and I know that as Freemasonry did a great work in the past of America, so can it do a still greater work in the future of our country. With the utmost respect and regard for other lands and peoples, our care is for America, our America, God's America. To keep it true to its high heroic tradition, three ruffians threaten the safety and sanctity of America: racial rancor, religious bigotry, and a disintegrating spirit of lawlessness. Here is our challenge and our opportunity, lest our temple of liberty and fraternity be injured or destroyed before it is completed and dedicated, for it is not yet complete. Racial rancor is a thing slithered with blood and the mother of feuds and wars. Religious bigotry is one of the worst and horrible things in history. Its story is a tragedy too terrible to tell. As for lawlessness, it strikes at the altar of liberty, undermines all our institutions, and opens the floodgates of anarchy. These ruffians, if they have their way, will wreck Freemasonry as they came near doing long ago, and they will ruin America. Freemasonry, by virtue of its spirit and its teachings, can do for America what no other fraternity can do. Without entering into a political debate or sectarian disputes, as in the past, so in the future, let us build upon the foundations laid by our fathers and make America what its poets and prophets have dreamed it should be. And to have even a little part in such a work is honor enough. It is honor enough. Well, there you have it. Quite a powerful speech by Fort Newton. You know, he says a few things in here that I just thought were, well, not only were they rough, but kind of funny. For instance, bread and butter Masons attending the big meets and big eats, using the Masonic apron for a napkin? Ouch. I think we all know some of those guys. But maybe they just don't know better. Maybe we're not firing on the cylinders that would encourage them to be coming to a lodge. Newton's commentary on America are interesting. And it sounds like somebody wrote that just recently. Although, they didn't. This is from quite a long time ago, back in 1923. Not so different today. We're getting through a pandemic. They had just gotten through one. Interesting stuff. Joseph Fort Newton. I'll have the entire paper in the app for you to download at your will. This next piece is called Freemasonry at the Table. It's by Brother Stephen E. Patrick, Rosslyn, Virginia. Few should be surprised to learn that the early history of the Masonic fraternity was spent in taverns. The craft met, as did virtually every other club and society of the day, in local inns and taverns. Often the proprietor would start a club simply as a means of drawing more business for his establishment. Freemasonry enjoyed a cheerful, convivial nature, and prints of the period reveal that lodges would actually perform ritual work while seated at a table spread with glasses, bottles, and copious punch bowls. As the ritual became more precise and stylized later in the 18th century, the habit of sitting at a table was replaced with the familiar practice of calling off to refreshment. Freemasonry exhorts the brethren to follow a number of virtues, including temperance, and even the earliest constitutions carried regulations against drunkenness in the lodge. The practice of enjoying wine and spirits in the lodge room was largely lost in America during the Prohibition movement of the 19th and early 20th centuries. For many of us, the physical remains of that era, of wine and song, are strange indeed. Pitchers used for ale or beer were a favorite with early Masons both at home and in the lodge room. Some were fairly expensive, hand-painted jugs with carefully delineated working tools and emblems, along with attractive floral sprays. The use of profuse Masonic symbols on all of these objects indicates the practice of using them as a sort of tracing board for instruction while enjoying a glass of beer. Other pitchers of cheaper production were also printed with Masonic designs, made about 1810 until 1820, and filled with working tools and other symbols. This pitcher contained the words to a popular Masonic song. The two pillars, sometimes marked J and B, were the object of the Grand Secretary Lawrence Jermyn's joke in the introduction to the ancient Grand Lodge of England's 1754 Book of Constitutions, known as the Ahiman Rezum. Dermot chided the fraternity, saying that many brethren were of the opinion that the pillars were barrels marked to distinguish the Jamaican rum from the Barbadian. Glassware also played an important role in the table of refreshment. These pieces range from crudely molded glass hip flasks with royal arch and many other Masonic symbols, circa 1820, to beautifully engraved lead crystal wine goblets with a simple square and compasses design and delicate borders, circa 1790. Criticism from within the fraternity that the use of alcohol made Masons susceptible to ridicule resulted in the eventual ban of its use in virtually all of the United States. However, these intriguing and often very attractive drinking implements are historic reminders of a time when a joyful collection of Masons would make numerous toasts and sing, "The world is all in darkness about us, they conjecture, but little think, a song and a drink succeeds the Mason's lecture." Stephen E. Patrick, member of Federal No. 1, Georgetown, D.C., Assistant Curator, Masonic Library and Museum in Philadelphia, PA, Curator of the George Washington Masonic National Memorial, Alexandria, Virginia, before assuming his present position as Director of the Hammond Harwood House, Annapolis, Maryland. Great history. I really had a chuckle at the J&B standing for Jamaican rum and Barbadian rum. I think we're going to do that maybe at a table lodge sometime when we can eventually pull that off. You know, that last bit, quote, "However, these intriguing and often very attractive drinking implements are historic reminders of a time when a joyful collection of Masons would make numerous toasts and sing." Let me change that. Quote, "However, these intriguing and often very attractive drinking implements are historic reminders of a better time and have a beer at a table lodge without some wild dispensations." It is what it is. So, great piece, awesome, and, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with the way it used to be, as long as our junior wardens are doing their duty to ensure nobody imbibes too much. All right, now for our third piece this week, we're going to do something we haven't done in a little while, and that is read a paper by Unknown. So this is called The Master's Piece, again, by Unknown. In the olden time, it was no easy matter for a man to become a Freemason. He had to win the right by hard work, technical skill, and personal worth. Then, as now, he had to prove himself a free man of lawful age, legitimate birth, of sound body, and good repute to even be eligible at all. Also, he had to bind himself to serve under rigid rules for 7 years, his service being at once a test of his character and a training for his work. If he proved incompetent or unworthy, he was sent away. In all operative lodges of the Middle Ages, as in the guilds of skilled artisans of the same period, young men entered as apprentices, vowing absolute obedience, for the lodge was a school of seven sciences, as well as of the art of building. At first, the apprentice was little more than a servant, doing the most menial work, and if he proved himself trustworthy and proficient, his wages were increased. But the rules were never relaxed, except at Christmas time, as the old charges tell us, when there was a period of freedom duly celebrated with feast and frolic. the rules by which an apprentice pledged himself to live, as we find them recorded in the old charges, were very strict. He had to first confess his faith in God, vowing to honor the church, the state, and the master under whom he served, agreeing not to be absent himself from the service of the order, save with the license of the master. He must be honest and upright, faithful in keeping the secrets of the craft and the confidence of his fellows. He must not only be chaste, but must not marry or contract himself to any woman during the time of his apprenticeship. He must be obedient to the master without argument or murmuring, respectful to all Freemasons, avoiding uncivil speech, free from slander and dispute. He must not frequent any tavern or alehouse except it be upon an errand of the master or with his consent. Such was the severe rule under which an apprentice learned the art and secrets of the craft. After 7 years of study and discipline, either in the lodge or the annual assembly, where awards were usually made, he presented his masterpiece, some bit of stone or metal carefully carved, for the inspection of the master, saying, quote-unquote, "Behold my experience," by which he meant the sum of his experiments. He had spoiled many a bit of stone. He had spent laborious nights and days, and the whole was in that tiny bit of work. His masterpiece was carefully examined by the masters assembled, and if it was approved, he was made a master mason, entitled to take his kit of tools and go out as a workman, a master and fellow of his craft. Not, however, until he had selected a mark by which his work could be identified, and renewed his vows to the order, in which he was now a fellow. The old order was first apprentice, then master, then fellow, membership being in the early time not a degree conferred, but a reward of skill as a workman and a merit as a man. The reversal of the order today is due, no doubt, to the custom of the German guilds, where the fellow craft was required to serve 2 additional years as a journeyman before becoming a master. No such custom was known in England. Indeed, the reverse was true. And it was the apprentice who prepared his masterpiece, and if it was accepted, he became a master. Having won his mastership, he was entitled to become a fellow, that is, a peer, and fellow of the craft which hitherto he had only served. Hence, all through the old charges, the order is masters and fellows, but there are signs to show that a distinction was made according to ability and skill. For example, in the Matthew Cook manuscript, we read that it had, quote-unquote, been ordained that they who were passing of cunning should be passing honored, and those less skilled were commanded to call the more skilled, quote-unquote, masters. Then it is added that, quote, they that were less of wit should not be called servant nor subject, but fellow, for nobility of their gentle blood, end quote. After this manner, our ancient brethren faced the fact of human inequality of ability and initiative. Those who were of greater skill had a higher position and were called masters, while the masses of the craft were called fellows. A further distinction must be made between master and a master of the work, now represented by the master of the lodge. Between a master and the master of the work, there was no difference, of course, except an accidental one. They were both masters and fellows. Any master could become a master of the work, provided he was of sufficient skill and had the fortune to be chosen as such either by the employer or the lodge, or both. What a rite or ritual, if any, accompanied the making of a master in the old operative lodges is still a matter of discussion. In an age devoted to ceremonial, it is hard to imagine such an important event without its appropriate ceremony. But the details are obscure. But this is plain enough. All the materials, out of which the degrees were later developed, existed, if not in drama, at least in legend. Elaborate drama would not be necessary in an operative lodge. Even today, much of what is acted out in an American lodge is merely recited in an English lodge. Students seem pretty well agreed that from a very early time there were 2 ceremonies or degrees, although no doubt in a much less elaborate form than now practiced. As the order, after the close of the cathedral building period, passed into its speculative character, there would naturally be many changes, and much that was routine in an operative lodge became ritual in a speculative lodge. This is not the time to discuss the origin and development of the third degree, except to say that those who imagined that it was an invention fabricated by Anderson and others at the time of the revival of Masonry in 1717 are clearly wrong. Such a degree could have never been imposed upon the craft unless it harmonized with some previous ceremony, or at least with ideas, traditions, and legends familiar and common to the members of the craft. That such ideas and traditions did exist in the craft, we have ample evidence. Long before 1717, we hear hints increase as the office of master of the work lost its practical aspect after the cathedral building period. What was the master's part? Unfortunately, we cannot discuss it in print, but nothing is plainer that we do not have to go outside of masonry itself to find the materials out of which all three degrees as they now exist were developed. Masonry was not invented. It grew. Today it unfolds its wise and good and beautiful truth in three noble and impressive degrees, and no man can take them to heart and not be ennobled and enriched by their dignity and beauty. The first lays emphasis upon that fundamental righteousness, without which a man is not a man, but a medley of warring passions, that purification of heart which is the basis alike of life and religion. The second lays stress upon the culture of the mind, the training of its faculties in the quest of knowledge, without which man remains a child. The third seeks to initiate us symbolically into the eternal life, making us victors over death before it arrives. The first is the degree of youth, the second, the degree of manhood, the third, the consolation and conquest of old age, when evening shadows fall, and the eternal world and its unknown adventure draw near. What then, for each of us today, is meant by the Master's Peace? It is simply a quaint custom handed down from our ancient brethren, in which we learn how an apprentice was made a master of his craft. It is that indeed, but much more, unless we have eyes to see double meaning everywhere in masonry, a moral application and a spiritual suggestion. We see little or nothing. But if we have eyes to see it, is always a parable, an allegory, a symbol, and the master's piece of an olden time becomes an emblem of that upon which every man is working, all the time and everywhere, whether he is aware of it or not, his character, his personality, by which he will be tested and tried at last. Character, as the word means, is something carved, something wrought out of the raw stuff and hard material of life. All we do, all we think, goes into the making of it. Every passion, every aspiration has to do with it. If we are selfish, it is ugly. If we are hateful, it is hideous. William James went so far as to say that just as the stubs remain in the checkbook to register the transaction when the check is removed, so every mental act, every deed becomes a part of our being and character. Such a fact makes a man ponder and consider what he is making out of his life, and what it will look like at the end. Like the masons of old, apprenticed in the school of life, we work for a penny a day. We never receive a large sum all at once, but the little reward of daily duties. The scholar, the man of science, attains truth, not in a day, but slowly, little by little, fact by fact. In the same way, day by day, act by act, we make our character by which we shall stand judged before the master of all good work. Often enough, men make such a bad botch of it that they have to begin all over again. The greatest truth taught in religion is the forgiveness of God, which erases the past and gives us another chance. All of us have spoiled enough material, dulled enough tools, and made enough mistakes to teach us that life without charity is cruel and bitter. Goethe, a great mason, said that talent may develop in solitude, but character is created in society. It is the fruit of fellowship. Genius may shine aloof and alone like a star, but goodness is social. And it takes two men and a god to make a brother. In the holy book which lies upon the altar, we read, "No man liveth unto himself, no man dieth unto himself." We are tied together, seeking that truth, which none may learn for another, and none may learn alone. If evil men can drag us down, good men can lift us up. No one of us is strong enough not to need the companionship of good men and the consecration of great ideals. Here lies perhaps the deepest meaning and value of Masonry. It is fellowship of men seeking goodness, and to yield ourselves to its influence, to be drawn into the spirits and quest, is to be made better than ourselves. Amid such influence, each of us is making his master's peace. God is all the time refining, polishing strokes, now tender, now terrible. That is the meaning of pain, sorrow, and death. It is the chisel of the master cutting the rough stone. How hard the mallet strikes, but the stone becomes a pillar, an arch, perhaps an altar emblem. Him that overcometh, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. The masterpiece of life, at once the best service to man and the fairest offering to God, is a pure, faithful, heroic, beautiful character. Oh, the cedars of Lebanon grow at our door, and the quarry is sunk at our gate, and the ships out of Ophir with golden ore for our summoning mandate wait, and the word of a master mason may the house of our soul create. While the day hath light, let the light be used, for no man shall night control. Or ever the silver cord be loosed, or broken the golden bowl, may we build King Solomon's temple in the true Masonic soul. Now that's the end of this piece. I really enjoyed the way it broke down the origin of the degrees, going from apprentice to master to fellow, which is kind of interesting. If you think about it, you know, a lot of Lodge of Researches, for instance, the Illinois Lodge of Research, or perhaps the Missouri Lodge of Research, of course, you go into those as Master Masons, but it is only by your work that you become a fellow. And I think that says something. Are you a fellow out there in the Masonic world, or just a Master Mason? Perhaps if we travel back to what Brother Fort Newton said, are we just guys showing up for the big meets and big eats? I don't know, but I do know one thing. This piece, fantastic. I really enjoyed it. Again, I will put this piece and the others that we read on the show this week within the app as a downloadable PDF, and you can get that by going to the Podcast Source app, either on Google Play or in the App Store, and search for the Whence Came You podcast, and you kind of are in the app and search for Whence Came You, and then you can add it to your shows, and it's like an app within an app. It's really easy to use, so I hope that doesn't sound too complicated. It's not too bad. If you need any help with it, shoot me an email, and I will walk you through it as best I can. That's the show for this week. I want to thank all of our contributors, our fellows, our producers of the program. Again, without you, we cannot make this show. If you are interested in assisting us, please head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see all the amazing ways you can assist. And likewise, check out the shop, where you can pick up some unique items and help out the show that way as well. I hope you had a great Halloween. I hope you get out there and exercise your constitutional right to vote. It is your civic duty, especially as a Freemason. And no matter what happens on November 3rd, let us remember to respond like Freemasons. That's it. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.